Boobies and Booze on Moncrief.
Of all the gin joints in all the world, she walks into mine.
A martini, shaken, not stirred.
I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
You're very welcome back. Tom Dunn standing in for Sean today. I'm very happy to welcome Leslie Williams, be joining us on all things wine related today. Finola Jones on all things showbiz related, and Brian Lloyd on the movies. You're all very welcome. There's already been a major incident in the studio.
Happy Friday.
One of the bottles has exploded or something. Is it all right over there, Leslie? What's going on?
No, it's okay. Just a bit of the wax. Right. The very fancy wax in the top of the very fancy bottle of wine.
Did you bring in the wrong wine, mate?
I did. I brought the fancy. Well, they're both really good, to be honest.
Right. So it's win-win for us.
It is a win-win.
This is all good.
But this one, I actually met this producer. I haven't met the other producer, so that's actually, I can talk about this producer a bit better because I've
met him. Okay. That's good.
Yeah.
So what is it exactly?
I'm a last-minute replacement today, so I didn't have a lot of time. So I thought, well, what will I bring in? And I thought, well, let's bring in the most expensive wines in the world.
Why not?
I see no unhappy faces.
So Burgundy is the world's most expensive wine region.
Is it?
Yes. To find a bottle of wine labeled a Bourgogne Burgundy, the basic entry level stuff, is you're going to have to pay over 30. I don't know what I'm supposed to put my prices, but that's where you're starting.
Just give us a ballpark where you start.
So what I have though is wines that are not much around that price, and that are really, really, really good. You could pay 20,000 for a bottle of Domaine de Romani Conti. The bottle of the 1945 will set you back about 900,000 euros.
900,000 euros.
Yeah. That's what it's a bottle sold in this year for 830. Do they just lie them down?
Yeah, yeah. Do they ever actually open one of them?
So I suspect these at this stage are assets. Yeah.
Right.
There's a famous story though of a really, really expensive bottle which the Forbes family bought and supposedly belonged to Thomas Jefferson. We now know it was a fake, but at the time they thought it belonged to Thomas Jefferson and was worth, you know, about 100,000+.
Right.
And someone was bringing it around to show people, look at the lovely bottle, and it smashed.
Oh God. And it does turn to acid, does it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Is there an age after which it's definitely acid?
No. I mean, it's a natural product. They die.
Right.
I mean,
you know, they talk about bottles of the Titanic and stuff. Would that be acid?
So that's not that long ago. That's only 100 years. So
right.
Champagne at the bottom of the sea is actually okay. And there is some famous wines from the Bay of between Estonia and Finland, whatever, or around that area, whatever that's called, from a ship that sank, and they had a little bit of sugar in them. There were sweeter champagnes, and they were rescued, and there was just part of the ship that they were investigating, and they said, "Oh, this is fun. We've found some old wine." But then they opened one and thought, "Golly, that tastes nice," and they've become legendary. And actually, they've turned up in movies.
Just now wines? If you found an old whiskey at the bottom of,
whiskey will be much more likely
forever
to survive. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Pretty much. And then the alcohol is what kills it.
Pickled in alcohol.
There's a lot more to explain. I think, I'll tell you in a minute.
Well, I'm just wondering.
I'm
intrigued by that. And I'm just wondering if people find themselves maybe in a situation where they're clearing out an old house, an old relative, and they're finding old bottles of wine. And
Absolutely. I mean, I would, if it's interesting and good and really old, I would auction it because there's some idiot out there who'll pay for the fact that it's an old bottle. If you're expecting to drink it, I'd be very circumspect.
Our capitalist king.
Yeah.
I drank a 1902 Madeira once and that was stunning because Madeira doesn't die. That's an example of a wine that doesn't die. But like a bottle of Burgundy, So I have a bottle of 2006 Burgundy in the cupboard and they're okay still. I mean, they're starting to fade, but they're still okay.
Sure.
And better wines will last longer. But I'm not going to...
Yeah.
Look, everyone thinks Chateau de Pape is going to be great. It's going to age forever. I've had 15-year-old bottles of Chateau de Pape that I thought were faded and gone. Now, it depends on the producer. It depends on the wine. It depends on how it's been stored. But yeah, wine does not last forever.
People try to get a wine from their birthday. You know, if somebody might be born.
Yeah, that's fine if you're 30.
If someone wants to celebrate their 50th,
you want to be really good stuff. Now, look, I opened a bottle of wine from my wife's birthday, which happened to be in a good year.
Yeah.
On her 40th birthday, and it was lovely. And she said a nice thing, which and I didn't prompt her on this. She said, I'm drinking the sunshine from the year I was born. And that's
exactly
what it is.
That's a beautiful thing. That's a beautiful
And she was born
thing.
In August, and she's dead right, because the sunshine in August is what makes a wine. And that was, And
it
that's
lovely. I love that.
Yeah. There's a thought. 53106 for your text on the oldest wine you've ever had. Look forward to that. You have two different wines for us. Did you tell us which two?
I brought in a wine from Kelly Sotel in Rosslare. I'm sure we've all know. Wonderful place, great place for kids and so on. I had two bottles of samples that they gave me, because they sell wine now through their website as well as being in the restaurant.
Yeah.
And he's bringing it in himself, and he wants his customers to enjoy the wine. So therefore, he doesn't put huge markups.
Sure.
So I had a Carillon Bourgogne Blanc from 2022, and I had a Leroux 2022. And they said, oh, we've none of the Leroux left. Don't bring that. So that's what I brought. I meant to bring the Carillon, because they have some Carillon 2022 Bourgogne Vintage, which is very, very similar in style. White
we'll
Burgundy
get to it again.
From...
I'm sure that's a day in the future. Brilliant. Look forward to that. Brian, are you excited about this week's films?
I'm excited about one of them.
That's good.
Wham, 10 Days in China.
Yeah, it's not Spider-Man then.
It's not that I'm not excited about it. It's that it's the ninth standalone Spider-Man movie, and this is the fourth time that Tom Holland has played Spider-Man. So, like, realistically, how excited can we get about a film that, you know, has been done before, arguably better?
Still likely to do really well at the box office?
Oh, God, yeah, it'll do gangbusters. Yeah, of course it will. Why wouldn't it? Like, you know, that kind of way. Like, of course it's going to do well. But it's just, are we just covering the same ground again? Is there doing anything that it hasn't necessarily done before? Fortunately not. But it's still, despite all that, I found it entertaining for what it was.
I saw Hail Mary recently.
Project Hail Mary?
Yeah.
What did you think?
My kids had gone mad about it.
Yeah.
And I thought it was like a take on a little bit E.T.-ish.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Cute alien. Like.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It was good.
It's good fun.
They loved it.
If you'd seen it in the cinema, you probably watched it on Prime Video, did you? Yeah, if you saw it in the cinema, it would have been better for you. Because it's meant to, like, the immensity of it is amplified in it.
I felt I needed to lower my expectations. I felt like my expectations are based on E.T. and classic films. I was expecting this had gone beyond that. It hadn't really. It just kind of repeated.
I know. I mean, like, it certainly has the sentimentality of E.T., you know, that kind of way. Like, there is that thing
that
of,
was
like,
lovely.
It's lovely. Yeah, it definitely
the bond
is.
Between him and The Rock was touching at times.
Come on, like, I mean, you Rocky, know, fist my bump.
Who hasn't fallen in love with a rock at some point? So, bring it on.
You're telling me, like, come on.
So moving away from that, Wham! 10 Days in China.
Yes, I really, really enjoyed this. Yeah, so this is an ill-fated documentary was made in 1985 by Lindsay Anderson, who, if you don't know, was the guy who directed This Sport and Life with Richard Harris. He also did If with Malcolm McDowell. And he was hired by Wham's management to basically film and document their tour in China. Needless to say, it didn't go according to plan. He broke his leg the first day he got to China, and Andrew Ridgeley and George Michael were being basically hounded by the press. So it's kind of like, on the one hand, it's very much a sort of fly-in-the-wall documentary. You are seeing literally anything and everything that was shot during the time period. And then Andrew Ridgeley and Simon Napier-Bell, who was their manager at the time, they're giving sort of retrospective interviews talking about and kind of giving context about where everything was. Like, they were the first Western pop act to tour China since the Cultural Revolution and Mao and all that. So,
and a very different China to the China of today, really.
Oh, completely. Oh, God, yeah, completely. Now, they even talk about it as well, like, in terms of, like, you know, Beijing was considered to be more conservative and stuff like that, whereas Canton was closer to Hong Kong and was a bit more sort of westernized, and the audiences were a bit more in it. But fascinating, kind of great kind of idea of, like, pop culture and geopolitics crossing over. And
looking forward to that. Finally, you kind of suspected Wham was some sort of, you know, take on, you weren't sure what it was.
I wasn't sure because there was a review here a couple of weeks ago, and I'm not sure if it was Brian or if it was you, Chris, but the Nirvana, the band, the film.
The Nirvana, the band,
whatever.
The show, the movie.
Yeah, exactly. So I didn't know if it was some kind of take on that. But now that I know it's a documentary, I'm a little bit more intrigued. So.
But Wham means nothing to you, does it?
It means Christmas.
Yes, of course.
But, like, beyond that, and I say that with no judgment. I just haven't had much time to investigate them otherwise. So now I've the perfect opportunity to. So.
Yeah. It's an odd thing. I think at the time they were naff. They were naff, yeah.
They were, yeah.
But then as the years went by, you kind of thought it was kind of good naff.
It is very, very, very catchy pop.
Yeah.
And you would know yourself, that's incredibly hard to write.
Wake
and
me
write
up
well.
You go.
Like, that's
Christmas I gave you my heart.
Yeah.
Very next day you gave it away this year to save me from tears. I'll give it to someone special.
everything you know what I mean? She wants.
That's a tune.
That's a tune.
Like, and like the fact that they were so inspired by like doo-wop 60s kind of pop acts, like they were covering the Miracles and stuff.
Yeah.
Is it not true that that was meant to be a summer song? Last summer, and then they changed it to Christmas. That's what I heard.
I don't know, but I could believe them if they did.
Yeah, you have to pivot. You can't pivot in this business.
Last summer does not have the same ring.
No, it doesn't have the same vibe.
Last summer I gave you.
No, the very next summer you gave it.
Nah, it's gonna work.
It's Christmas.
And listen, in the world of your world. Netflix and the stolen Nicolas Cage movie.
Yeah, this could nearly be a film in and of itself. Netflix are currently being sued for $105 million over the theft of a hard drive that contained an unreleased Nicolas Cage war movie. So this film was called Fortitude, and it was coming from a first-time screenwriter called Simon Afram, who's been kind of kicking this around for like a very long time, was involved in a separate lawsuit with Martin Scorsese, who at one point was attached to the project. They ended up settling out of court. He was supposed to be working on the project and it all got a bit messy. But this film called Fortitude, basically they had dropped it off on a hard drive to Netflix. I think Netflix had seen some promotional materials for it at the end of last year. So they expressed interest then on taking it onto the streamer. So they received a copy of the film in June then. And they were also sent this digital copy. And basically now they've said that they were the target of this theft, basically that a couple of these hard drives were taken. They went back to the team for Fortitude and saying, you know, that we've been through the security teams and we've had no luck. Our piracy team are on high alert now for breaches and we'll monitor. But basically the Fortitude team are arguing that, you know, with this now potentially being out into the world, it's going to make it really hard to sell it as a concept anyway. So this could be a big, big coup for them, I will say. Well, though I will say initially they were like, it's a bit weird that they were like, oh yeah, like this has kind of never happened. And they were just, I think there were some people weren't fully sure if they had filed their own report with LAPD. Yeah. So then it was like, did someone just fire this in a bin or something? Maybe, I don't know. But basically, yeah, the lawsuit's claiming that any future sale of the film has been put in jeopardy. It'll affect their international release strategy, awards campaign paused. It could be very, very messy for them. Sounds like a good film too,
because it's a big film, isn't it?
Sounds like a good film to be made. The film to be made of this situation, I think interesting. The film in and of itself, not my cup of tea, but I'm sure someone would watch
it. My cup of tea. World War II, Codebreakers.
Yeah.
All that kind of stuff.
London set espionage thriller, British intelligence operatives. Yeah. Like, I'm asleep, but you're sitting up in your chair, suddenly saying...
I'm only after waking up.
Yeah, I mean, semi-decent cast. You're talking about Nicolas Cage, Matthew Good, Michael Sheen, Ben Kingsley.
Semi-decent. That's actually decent, Ben Kingsley.
How could you possibly call that semi-decent?
Directed by Simon West. Simon West, he did Con Air.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but now it's like, because it's out there in the world, as you say, like, will it become one of those things where it's like, they do eventually get it back? Yeah. And they also do have a digital copy, as far as I'm aware. So I'm like, where is that?
Yeah.
Because it was, they sent it over on a hard drive and a digital copy so that they could like review and then delete it afterwards. So obviously someone watched it and then deleted it afterwards, but now they don't have the hard drive.
Yeah. And listen, does Martin Scorsese feature in this to an extent as well for some reason?
He's not attached to the project anymore as far as I'm aware, but it was just that kind of initial tete-a-tete between himself and Simon Afram when Simon Afram brought him on to help develop the film.
Yeah.
He felt like he kind of didn't get his money's worth, I suppose, so then sued Scorsese. I think he ended up taking, was it $500,000? Yeah, basically to help him kind of develop the film. Simon didn't think he got his money's worth, so they sued him. Scorsese's lawyer came out and said it was a classic example of a novice filmmaker who refuses to appreciate the stark difference between expectation and reality in the filmmaking business. But it was later settled out of court. So
sounds like a dark little tale going on there as well, my friends. Very good. I'll be looking forward to that,
yes.
I'm afraid.
You enjoy that wherever
Michael
it appears.
Ben Kingsley. It's very strange. Wine has arrived in a strange glass. So we'll have more. Keep your texts coming on. A listener has had a 45-year-old Ryoka from 1978, they say was absolutely beautiful. So there you go.
Yes, Ryoka. Ryoka does age. I've had 60s Ryokas. Actually, and you know, believe it or not, Festina 1, a brand we all know in the fakey bottle with the Rembrandt powder on. They were some anniversary and they had a dinner and I was invited and there was some wines from the 60s and they were delicious.
Wow. Keep them coming. 53106, we'll have a break and we'll have our first movie after this.
Quit your whimper.
You can't just shoot yourself out of every situation. Innocent people get hurt.
What do you think's downrange of that tank, dum-dum?
Suit yourself.
Go home, Frank!
Until he swore there, I thought it sounded like a clip from Toy Story 3. It just sounded like loads of toys throwing themselves around a room.
You're not far wrong, like, in fairness. Like, this is a comic book movie. It's Spider-Man. You heard Frank Castle there, played by John Bernthal. If you don't know Frank Castle, it was a character known as the Punisher. He was very much like an R-rated. He shot people. He had no qualms about killing people, etc., etc. So the idea of putting that character in with Spider-Man, who is, you know, kids love him. You know, he's Spider-Man. He swings from buildings. He's, you know, da 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 da. It's, there is an element of this film that I think maybe the director of it, Destin Daniel Cretton, is aware of the fact that this is the ninth Spider-Man movie. So it's like, how can we really kind of do anything here that we haven't done before? So what they've done with this, I think, is they have acknowledged that, you know, Spider-Man lives in this much broader world, and that, like, New York is a place where, you know, you can walk down the street and it is entirely possible that you will meet some gun-toting maniac who had his family killed and is in, and interacts with him in a very sort of family-friendly way. What are you doing?
He's opening a bottle of wine.
Jesus!
He's opening
a bottle of
wine.
I didn't know what he was doing. I could hear something out of the side. Sorry.
Squeak, squeak.
Christ!
You want to know, it's not called... movies and
I know, but like, I didn't know what that was. Like, I genuinely, I thought he was like messing with a zip tie.
He
did
like the take on New York, so
I'm sorry.
He said
it was the squeak. You're, I was trying to imitate the squeaking rats in New York City. That's what I was doing.
Well, yeah, true. Yeah,
you're perfectly safe.
I know, but just panic, like for a split second. Like, I thought I was having a stroke. Anyways, they bring in a lot of like supporting characters in this to try kind of bolster it a little bit, but really it kind of hinges on Tom Holland's performance, and he is, you know, no longer a boy, he is more of a man now, he's much more mature and stuff like that. And, you know, what's going on in this is Spider-Man at the end of the last film had to cast a spell with the help of Doctor Strange to essentially wipe his identity from the world, so no one knew that Peter Parker was Spider-Man.
Brilliant.
Yeah. So now he's back to square one and he's very much kind of gone into himself. He's only just kind of working as Spider-Man. Peter Parker has been kind of left on the shelf, so to speak. But that in and of itself is becoming a problem for him because his powers are starting to develop in a kind of a more unusual way, and it's making him a little bit kind of more terrifying, let's say. He's hitting people harder than he should be and all the rest of it. And that's an interesting point, but again, that's been done before. They did that in Spider-Man 3 with Tobey Maguire when he got the Venom symbiote and stuff. So again, you're watching this and it's like, this has been done before, arguably done better. Yet, for all of that, I have to say I enjoyed it. I mean, the action set pieces are done very, very well. You know, some of the shots are literally pulled straight from a comic book. Like, they literally just put it onto the screen and stuff like that. So it has its moments there. As I was saying to you before, this is going to do gangbusters at the box office, so it doesn't really matter what I say.
Fair enough. My daughter saw it. Yesterday.
Well, what'd she think?
She loved it.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
As, yeah.
Yeah.
But is that it then? Because it seemed like with the last one, it was like...
It's never it.
I know, but like... So it's not.
No, he's going to be in Avengers Doomsday, which is out on December 18th.
And then he'll age out and they'll find a new Spider-Man and they'll start the whole...
They've already talked about that. They've said like, I'm going to age out of this and we have a replacement kind of ready to go and stuff. And
as long as the well produces water.
Yeah.
This is it. Until these, like, people are saying like, oh, superhero fatigue. Until these films stop making money, the minute they lose money on these films, they'll stop making them. That's it.
Yeah. Out of five, what would you give this?
Three out of five.
Perfectly good.
Yeah, people perfectly
will enjoy
fine.
It.
Perfectly
expect. You have a story, Fionnuala, about Cinderella the movie and the absolute lack of its soundtrack on streaming, which
this
I find hard to follow.
Is so interesting. So this is a piece from Vanity Fair and this concerns the Cinderella that came out in 1997 from Rodgers and Hammerstein, and it was a made-for-TV movie starring Whitney Houston and then teenage Brandy Norwood. So she was 16. Two black leads. And like, you remember from like the music, like, I think people will anyway. Like, there's this clip of them that's gone viral from them in the studio where they're going, impossible, impossible. Do you remember that song?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. It used to be always on RT. Yeah. But it was this made-for-TV movie, and as I said, it was kind of groundbreaking at the time for this decision for there to be two black leads. Obviously, Whitney Houston is at kind of the peak of her career at this point. Brandy is this kind of new ingenue, but it's also, again, going to go on to have this incredible career in R&B. Pulled in 60 million viewers when it first aired on November 2nd, 1997. And at the time, it was the best-selling home video of any made-for-TV movie at that time. People still love it. People are still obsessed with it. It was never released. The soundtrack of it was never released on like CD, vinyl, anywhere.
That's unusual.
It's not on streaming anywhere. And it's coming up to its 30th anniversary. So basically Vanity Fair has kind of gone to all these sources to figure out why this was the case, because again, you're talking about like it would have done gangbusters in terms of sales as well. They talked about how Craig Zadon, who I think was one of the producers on the film, he sadly died in 2018, but he talked about after Whitney's death, he said that the CD never coming out was the greatest heartbreak of Whitney Houston's career. And she said that it didn't make sense to her, that there was no album, she just couldn't understand it. Basically, when you read into the piece, Brandy was with a different record label. I think she was with Atlantic at the time. And Atlantic were kind of known for their success in bringing like cross-genre artists to, and especially in the R&B frame. They were worried that it would kind of like ruin her street cred so early on to release this like musical theatre album, and like they're doing opera on it and all and stuff, but like it's excellent, it's class. Whitney then obviously was with Clive Davis on Arista Records. They were also a bit reluctant because again, she's at the height of her career. They kind of slightly relented then, I think. And then they were like, oh yeah, we could like release it. We could, whatever. But then apparently it was Disney that were also then holding back. So Disney have like saying it. If you want to watch this film, by the way, it's on Disney Plus. I would recommend it. So your kids will love it. And basically now we've have another like fourth record label coming in who is this vested interest now called Concord. They're the largest independent music publishing company in the world. And they're actually run by Imogen Lloyd Webber, who is the daughter of Andrew Lloyd Webber. And they're trying to get in now, and basically they own the rights, I should say, to Rodgers and Hammerstein's entire catalogue.
Okay.
So they're now trying to intervene and say it is absolutely ludicrous that this isn't anywhere to listen to or buy. So we're going to do something about it. As I said, the 30th anniversary is next year. Brandy's actually come back and started to play Cinderella in this Disney Channel movie called Descendants, which is about the
Descendants
of the fairy tale characters. Kids will know it. I don't expect adults to have any idea about it. I'd say your kids are into it if they're into it. But it's just fascinating because a few weeks ago we talked about Spice World and how that wasn't on streaming and how if you didn't have physical media, like stuff can just be lost till the end of the time. And then this is a really it's a similar example, but it's totally different in the sense that this never went anywhere.
Yeah.
But people have memory of it. Yeah, exactly. Like, it's just not. And again, they talk to one of the sources in this piece where he's like, I have a copy of it. And like, I'm sending it to the teams to be like, why can we not release it or whatever?
So it sounds like it's getting more complicated though, because there's more record companies getting involved, Disney and now Concord as well.
Yeah, and then Disney obviously have gone through loads of changes with Bob Iger and stuff like that. It's probably not top of their priority list, but I thought it was just so interesting, as well as so much time has passed now as well, that a load of the executives and the employees involved at all three groups, you know, like they're not around, they might not be around anymore, they might have moved on to other projects or whatever. Some of them weren't even born, do you know what I mean? That are now having to negotiate all this red tape, label stuff. It should be kind of simple, you know
what I mean?
It sounds
like at some point one of them will own the other three and then it'll be released.
Yeah, that's the thing, just swallow them all up.
That's the way it's going, and it will be Disney.
Yeah.
Mm.
They will own them.
Anyway, go watch that film if you've never seen it, because it is brilliant.
We're moving towards our first wine. Leslie, it's going to be the white.
Yes.
Tell me more.
So it is Benjamin Leroux Bourgogne. What I've done is today, I've put in two wines that are, you know, that it represents the best parts of Burgundy, but are not the crazy prices, because Burgundy will frequently cost over hundreds. I have a Mirange Vieille Vigne, old vine from Bodin Green Man, which Vinastito bring in. Mirange is the most southerly part of the Côte d'Or. And then I have just a ordinary Bourgogne Blanc from one of the great producers of Burgundy, which is Benjamin Leroux. I was meant to bring in a François Carillon, who's this amazing producer in Pouilly-Monchet, but I brought the wrong bottle. Anyway, both are great producers, Leroux, I've actually met, really interesting guy, started, like, made his first wines when he was in his mid-20s and, you know, was already talked about as one of the great producers, and he's now, that's 20 years ago. So it is a bit of oak in this. It's peachy, it's apricot, it's sort of now almost peachy, almost apricot, I think, anyway. But there's a little bit of oak, but there's texture, there's fragrance.
It's really beautiful.
It lingers. This is the 2022 vintage. This would age for 12 years. But I was a bit negative about wines aging. Lots of wines age, but be very careful what you're buying.
Sure.
Supermarket stuff does not age, okay? Yeah. Like old Bordeaux's, old Riocas, maybe, and Rieslings and things, but just be really
careful. Most supermarket wines are not really going to get a chance to age. No,
this is true. And this is most wine is drunk within 24 hours. But very quickly on why I met. Yeah, 99% is drunk within 24 hours or something like this. Yeah. So Benjamin and I met in Kelly's because of the fact that they bring their wine producers over. And in fact, they're doing this in November when you can meet one of the Avrils because Bill Kelly's married to an Avril, which is Clos de Pape, Chateau de Pape. Okay. And there's also a Chablis producer going. And it's a great place to drink Burgundy at fair prices.
Sounds great. It tastes absolutely delicious.
Yeah, no, it's a stunning
one. Reaction on that?
Very delicious.
Yeah, we're both on very, very strongly delicious.
And it's the texture, it's the balance. I mean, it's got fruit, it's got layers of fruit and sweetness, but also the structural elements, so it's kind of chewy.
Great glass as well.
So that is a Riedel glass, Riedel Wings glass.
No stem.
Specifically designed for Pinot Noir, which is what we're drinking
really
next.
Really lovely. Do have a few questions for you. I have a bottle of red 1994 Fort de la Tour from the Rothschild Estate.
Okay, very nice. Not from the Rothschild Estate, though. Fort de la Tour, or maybe it is. Fort de la Tour is, so, okay, it's not Chateau Latour, right?
Yeah.
And I don't think, is it not their second wine, Fort de la Tour? That's
no,
the second one. One of the second wines of Chateau. 94 is a solid vintage, not as good as 95, and not as good as 90, but between those two, and really, that should be absolutely fine from their five. Like, if you've got two, definitely want to see how it's going. Or borrow a caravan, which is a way of stealing wine from the top of it and see how it's going, and that won't affect the quality. Sure. You can still age it. I wouldn't leave it a lot longer, maybe 10 years more maximum. But and also, they need to look that up. I don't think it's Rothschild. I think if it's the second one of Chateau Latour, if that's the foot that I'm thinking of, then that should last another 20 years.
And this, I hope I can pronounce correctly. Doing a tidy up, say I found a bottle of 2010 Gurrier. That's what it looks like.
No,
Gurrieri, Rosardi. Third crew
Rizzardi
Amarone.
So Amarone is meant to last forever. I'm not sure it does last forever, but it is still a wine that will absolutely age. That's one of the absolute stunning producers in Amarone, Valpolicella di Amarone, near Lake Garda. Their counts, again, O'Brien's bring it in. Their wines across their range, from their entry level Pinot Grigios and Luganas to their Proseccos, even, is excellent. And that's one of their, not their top, but their sort of third from top wine, and it's excellent. Right. Yeah, and I would again don't wait for the special occasion to open the bottle. Make the occasion special by opening the bottle.
Hey.
Very good. I feel like I had that in the chamber always, just waiting for the.
Very good. We'll have a break, and we'll be back on our second movie and our second wine after this. You're very welcome back. I think we're going to go straight into Wham! 10 days in China. Take a listen to this.
Wham's timing was exquisite.
There was a hunger in China for connection with the West.
Their eyes were open, their hearts were humming.
So, Julia, you're in there.
My eye fell on George Michael. It's so sexy.
Had George met those for whom Wham was a life-changing moment, he would have been profoundly moved.
You've done it all now. That's a bit.
God, it's amazing listening to that. That's from Wham! 10 Days in China. At the time, as you say, I thought they were a novelty act as well.
Oh, yeah, no, for sure.
Now
I
listen back to it, I think that's pretty great music.
I mean, it's really, there's a real richness to their sound, I think, that you just don't see anymore. Like, it's so kind of sophisticated and stuff like that. But anyways, yeah, so what's going on in this was that their manager was trying to launch Wham! Into the US. And he thought that the best way to do it was to basically do a tour in China, because at the time, China was beginning to open up after the Cultural Revolution and so on and so forth. And he felt that, you know, the first Western pop act to tour through China, that'll be all over the US news. And by the time we bring Wham! To America, you'll be, you know, everyone will be talking about
it. Sounds
you know,
clever.
Very, very clever, yeah. And like they talk about it in the film, like Andrew Ridgely and Simon Napier-Bell are very upfront about it. Like, we had no interest in going to China. This was not a cultural exchange in any way, shape or form. This was purely strategic and so on and so forth. But when they get there and when they see the impact that their music had on Chinese people, because again, you have to remember, up until this point, like the only music that really would have been played in Beijing would have been like, you know, classical music and stuff like this. Or, you know, even if it was jazz, it would have been like incredibly structured kind of stuff, like renditions as opposed to kind of compositions and stuff. And like, even like, you know, like when you bought a ticket for the Worker Stadium concert and stuff like that, they get like a tape deck and you see there's footage of like the kids running up to a, like an electronics store and getting like asking to use the boombox to play the music and stuff like that. And then like the small little crowd comes around. And so it's very kind of endearing.
Exciting for them.
That's what I'm saying. It's very endearing. You're watching it like, and then it cuts to an interview like of a guy in his 60s who was at that concert. And he says like, you know, I heard that music and I was like, that's it. Now I have to be a rock DJ and I've got to go off and do this. Yeah.
And it becomes a Chinese.
He becomes like the first rock DJ in China who played like Western music and stuff like that. And another guy becomes a musician off the back of it. So you think of like, and like, you know, we think about like, you know, Velvet Underground and that whole thing that everyone who saw Velvet Underground went off to start a band. Well, here's Wham. Everyone that heard Wham in China went off and did something with it. Like, so it's just about the impact of it, I guess.
And what's it like for them? How are they? I mean, it must have been weird for them.
It's weird for them. I mean, see, this is the thing that I would have loved to have seen a bit more of, right? Because the rumour always was, and I don't think this was true, but George Michael's father apparently was expelled from Greece, Cyprus, because he was a communist, right? And George Michael was a member of the Young Communist League when he was a kid and stuff. And
wow.
Well, he was quite a socialist. Like, he was very upfront about his politics and stuff. Like, you heard him talking about Palestine or whatever and all the rest of it. Like, he was very forthright on it and stuff. And this is him touring a communist country, and there's like this one little clip in it where he's like getting a massage and stuff, and it's like very funny, like, and you know, everyone's kind of like, what the hell is going on here? And he's all like, yeah, you know, I didn't really think too much about how different it would be, it's kind of struck me. And it's like, talk more about that, like, give me something a bit more kind of in depth, and then it just cuts off to something else.
They're
like,
kind of unaware, though, aren't they, really, of the bigger picture, I suppose.
Yeah, there's an element of like them being just kind of shepherded through photo calls and stuff. And you can, Andrew Ridgely talks about it afterwards. He was like, I didn't know what was going on, just cameras were going nonstop, and you know, they really had a very antagonistic attitude to the media. Which,
how did the two of them get on?
You can feel them snapping at each other. Again, this is a thing that you get. Like, there's a lot of, like, you know, hot mic moments. Like, there's one bit where Ridgely turns around to George Michael and he calls him Yogg, because that was his nickname for him. He goes, Yogg, geez, you're not making life easiest for us here. Like, what are you doing? Like, stop antagonizing. He's talking about the media and stuff. And then there's other scenes where you can just see, like, George Michael just walks off and just goes away and leaves Ridgely to kind of talk to people and stuff. And Ridgely's just like, okay, right. Hope you enjoy the gig. Thanks so much. Cheers.
One of our listeners texts says, Andrew Ridgely was staying in the same hotel as us when skiing last year. His table was next to ours in the restaurant. Lovely, friendly guy. Mm. Lots of chats with him during the week, Eamon Kilkenny says.
I would believe that. Yeah, he seems like a very cool guy. Like, you know, very kind of like, has gone through a lot.
There was a documentary about 2 or 3 years. Yes. I found that joyful.
The George Michael story.
Yeah,
incredible.
I loved
it. Incredible. And like the people that they got to do that, like Tracy Emin talking about her, like hanging, partying with him and stuff like this. And then you get like Liam Gallagher, like, who's famously, you know, not exactly the most giving of people. And him talking about like that great song that George Michael did with Paul McCartney, Heal the Pain, and just... Oh, great, what song. A brilliant documentary. Like,
is this the same? This uplifting?
Not as good.
No.
Not as good. I think that documentary is one of the best music documentaries I've ever seen. Okay. You should watch that, by the way.
Right. Out of 5 for this?
3.5, 4. It's enjoyable.
All right.
That's his moment.
I thought you'd go a bit higher there.
No, it's good. It's just, I was always hoping for more out of it. Like, but it's still enjoyable, definitely.
All right. We're moving to our second wine now, Leslie, and it's going to be a red.
It is a red. Okay, so let me just give you a quick bit of geography lesson, right? So you go out of Paris and you go southeast of Paris, you hit Chablis. That's the very north part of Burgundy. Only white wine, only Chardonnay based, delicious, tense, gorgeous, getting expensive. You then go about an hour southeast of that again, and you hit Dijon. South of Dijon is where the vineyards begin for Burgundy. And that is the Côte de Nuits at the top, based around Nuits Saint-Georges, the village of Nuits. St. George, and then so Côte d'Ivoire, the hills around Nui, and then you hit Beaune, and around the hills of Beaune basically is Côte de Beaune, and then that's the Beaune. So there's the two sections, Nui and Beaune. Beaune usually a little more fragrant, a little more feminine, we used to say, we're not allowed to say that anymore. Nui being a bit more harder, harsher, masculine, but both age and so on. And then at the end of Côte de Beaune, this is the Côte d'Or between Nui and Beaune, and then you get into the Côte Chalonnaise, and then into the Mâcon. Now Mâcon, everyone knows Mâcon Luni, dead cheap. The village of Chardonnay is in Mâcon. That's actually where the name of the grape comes from, or the other way around, possibly. And then said that is Beaujolais, and Beaujolais technically is still Burgundy. And so Coteau Bourguignon is the cheapest Burgundy you can get, but it's usually mixed with Gamay, not the noble Pinot Noir, and we want Pinot Noir. So this is the most southerly village in Beaune, right? So you're still in the Côte d'Or, you're still in the classic proper producing area. All these cooler villages in this southern area, places like Saint-Aubin, the hot Côte d'Nuit up in the mountains almost, these are now good value, drinkable, delicious wines. Pernon Vergelès, Montlis, these are villages that are less known, and that's where you look. Don't be looking in Gevrey, Chambertin, you can't afford it. Don't be looking in. And Chambertin anyway is what you should be buying, but that's thousands. Gevrey is the village beside Chambertin. And then, so it's look for the smaller villages you've never heard of. If you haven't heard of it, it's going to be a better price. That's what I buy. I buy Pernod Vergelès. I've some Jean-Claude Ramonet Pernod Vergelès, one of the greatest producers in the world. And it wasn't that expensive. And I got it from Kelly's because they bring in his wine. So this is a really good example of a affordable Burgundy, Morange from Domaine Maurice Charlus, imported by Finistito. I got it in Green Man. It is red fruit. Now, Burgundy is red fruit. It is not, it's strawberries and raspberries. Nothing blackcurrant, okay? In fact, when the French say the colour of your jumper is a dark red, it's not called Burgundy there, it's called Bordeaux, because that's the actual colour of it. It's a dark red. What we call Burgundy is nothing like the colour of Burgundy. If you look at this, it's quite cherry red almost.
Yeah.
Now,
it's like Ribena.
Yeah.
So
when you smell it, there's all like kinds of... There's red fruits, but there's also kind of sous-bois, right, which is the forest walk. You're walking through a forest in the autumn, kicking the leaves along, and you get that sort of earthy, mushroomy character. That's typical of Burgundy. And so it's those sort of earthy notes, that those sort of gamey notes, we used to say almost, and those mixing with the red fruits, and it's all about. And the reason this glass is so oddly shaped is to allow the smells to come out, basically.
Okay. Gorgeous glass again, yeah. Another retail.
But there's loads of complexity going in here. You just sit there smelling Burgundies like this. It's quite lightweight, and it should be. It's quite textured, and this will, because of the texture and the acidity, last a long time, but not for 30 years. I'm talking, this is maybe a 20 year.
I wish we had a camera here, because the face you made when you took a sip of that.
That was absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's gorgeous. It's lingering. It's sweet, but it's also textured, and then it lingers with this kind of spiky note on the middle, and then cherry fruits come in, and then sort of cherry skins. So just then again, Morange. So where can you get this? Green Man, 64 wines, a good independence. It's an example of, like, you know, when I say, you know, this is, you'd spend much less on a bottle in a restaurant.
Reminds me more of Italian.
There is that sort of cherry character, which is very typical of Italian wines.
Yeah,
and red Burgundy is expensive, but look, a bottle of wine in any decent restaurant is now over 40 euros. This is significantly less than that.
Very good.
Well, it's noticeably less. Let's say.
Fanula, have we reaction over there?
Very nice.
Yeah. You've moved from delicious.
Don't be afraid
to very
of
nice.
Burgundy is scary, but don't be afraid.
Yeah, I think I'm usually afraid of it, but I'm not afraid of that. So.
Glad you're not afraid.
There you go.
We work off the same two or three words to describe our wines. Yeah. I see, delicious.
Why? He's doing
everything here. It's fantastic. Like.
That's excellent. Yes, I like
it. It's like a walk through an autumn wood. Like, come on, that's poetic.
It is. It's poetry. It's beautiful.
True.
Cheers.
Very very
yes,
nice
cheers.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Be not afraid.
Be not afraid. Wham and China listeners tell me that Andrew Ridgely made a point of saying on the BBC's One Show that the chieftains were in China before Wham.
Interesting.
Nice.
But they were the first. I did say they were the first pop act. The chieftains were not pop, but that's interesting.
My nephew's band got a tour in China about
really
before COVID, about 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I was there. I was
the Luna Boys, and he was saying they were treated as absolute gods everywhere they went. That it's still a gulf.
Still oh, yeah.
A huge gulf.
Definitely.
So when they see, you know, Western band, it's just this assumption.
They go for it, yeah, definitely. Like I was in Beijing and I was in Hong Kong, and it is definitely different. That is one way to call it. It is very, very different. But great, great trip. Loved it. Had a great time, great
and
food.
If they ever want to hear a parachute and know its glories, they know where to contact me. Over to AI is just hilarious.
Oh, really is.
We're in such fear of what it's going to produce, you know. And then there's also this story where even the taint of it is enough to destroy the credibility of something.
Yeah, I just thought this is a really interesting story in Deadline this week. So this is about an unpublished debut novel called Call Me, I'll Hide the Body. And it basically, it was generating a huge amount of buzz. They were looking at a $2.4 million deal for the novel and the follow-up.
There was talk
of movie adaptations like right out the gate, essentially. But those plans were all scuppered because questions were raised over whether the author in question, and I haven't named the author deliberately, and they're not named in the Deadline piece because, again, can you be the author if you potentially used AI? Basically, these questions have been raised over whether the author used AI as a tool in the writing of the book. But the problem that they've kind of sought out is publishers and movie companies might not be able to register copyright and come away with a clear title chain if there are certain AI elements in the mix. So even if, like, and basically I don't think they flagged it from the manuscript side, but I think when it was ran through something else, or I think they said specifically when it came to movie TV interest and that kind of started heating up, they ran it through something, or there were certain flags that were raised by the specific AI sensors. So now the deal is kaput, basically.
So many questions there. One, could you have your own debut novel? You've written, it's a genuine thing. You've used AI to help you with punctuation. You decided I'm not the greatest on the old punctuation thing, and you've run it through an AI engine. And then that is now appearing as trace elements of AI, which is making a publisher thinking this isn't it.
See, I don't know. I'm not sure. But then, Tom, I would argue, should you be writing, if you feel so unconfident in your, and that's probably not a word, so the hack of me making this point, but if you lack the confidence in your own grammar and spelling, should you be writing the book?
Well, have you ever used AI to help you with punctuation? I have.
No.
And
no,
I come away from it going,
not deliberately,
it's
not.
Like working with somebody who's just smarter than you.
But like, okay, I have a little bit of experience in this. I have talked to authors, and they have line editors. They literally, they give the manuscript to a line editor who literally goes, literally the thing is, they go through it line by line. This line editor reads it through and would check punctuation, would check spelling, would check syntax, would check all these kind of things. So like, when you hand, you know, the whatever, how many draft manuscripts to a line editor, they would be the one that would check through it. If they've used AI, then they're at fault.
Yeah.
But
you're the one who's going to pay the price. If you're the author, and if that then goes to the publisher.
You shouldn't be using AI. You should not be
using. But you're using a line editor. And
yeah, but you're using a person.
AI.
Like, okay, Leslie is the line editor. Yeah. Okay.
Leslie uses AI.
I've written the book.
My book gets...
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, but I've written this book. I've not used AI at any point in time. I hand it to Leslie. Mm-hmm. Leslie is the line editor. Leslie...
Have I been drinking wine?
Yes. And because he's had some of the beautiful Marin
Barange,
and he said, you know what, I'm going to get an AI to
I'll
edit
tell you
this.
Why I find this really interesting.
Go on.
Because obviously the debate is on at the moment mostly in music.
Yeah, okay? Suno and stuff.
Where all of the copyrighted works of the world have been copied without permission.
Yeah.
You know, and now can show up. But you could use something very innocently to write an essentially original
idea. I take that point, and I think that's very different than going to whatever AI thing and being like, come up with this story, which again, I'm not sure is the full allegation. And I think this was a developing story from Wednesday, so I'm sure there'll be more that will come out of it. Basically, the story was about, the loose plot line was that it was followed this guy, he had a chemistry degree and he relocates and he's able to use this chemistry degree to get rid of bodies, which the cartels are very interested in. For crime and stuff like that. Like, I think it's very different if you're going, hey, can you just check this for spelling mistakes? Even though I personally don't really endorse that either. That's a different thing.
You'd make you fearful of using any kind of AI at all.
You should be fearful of it.
It's
plagiarism.
Not if you're using it to check your spelling.
I'm sorry, but that thing is, it is the fruit of the poisonous tree.
Yeah, the whole AI model is based off of...
I'm very angry about AI. We're not angry enough about it.
Train your children up
other people, you know?
Children don't use it. They're very strong.
Thank God.
Good.
Data
set. Good.
No, I meant train them up on how to check your spelling. And
all right. Yeah. You're shaking the wrong tree now. Right, thank you very much for that indeed. That sadly is it for today on the show.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Of all the gin joints in all the world, she walks into mine.
The martini, shaken not stirred.
I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.